You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of June 2016 on Monocle 24. Live from Studio One here in London, you're listening to Midori House. Coming up,
Brits don't quit. We get involved, we take a lead, we make a difference, we get things done. If we left, our neighbours would go on meeting and making decisions that profoundly affect us, affect our country, affect our jobs, but we wouldn't be there.
A final plea from British Prime Minister David Cameron for Britain to remain in the European Union ahead of tomorrow's referendum. Polls suggest a tight race that is too close to call. Plus,
if he loses, people will say, why didn't he tackle immigration? Why didn't he talk about immigration? Because it's all been about the economics and the fear factor.
That's Financial Times editor Lionel Barber. A Leave vote would dramatically alter the face of modern Europe. It would also change Britain's Conservative Party. We'll be discussing that too. And we'll also ask why Germany hasn't quite faced up to the somewhat discomforting Brexit reality. And also, what is the process for leaving the EU? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Okay, one topic today, really, and that is Brexit. My guests today are Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow at Chatham House and contributor, really, for the Financial Times, and Isabel Hilton, Editor of China Dialogue. Quentin and Isabel, welcome to you both. The polls open first thing tomorrow morning, Quentin Peel, and when we look at the opinion polls so far, it is too close to call. Whether we trust opinion polls or not is kind of moot now. I'm not going to ask you to predict what's going to happen, but let's look at sort of what you think of the campaign so far.
Well, it's been both pretty disappointing and very emotional. And I think that the bad thing about it is that it's been spun on both sides, really. The truth's been spun. And it's been very difficult for people who are undecided to make up their minds. But what you've actually seen for the last 3.5 months is those who want to leave and those who want to remain absolutely locked in a sort of dead heat. And it's still there.
I'll bring you in a moment as well. But on this issue of like the truth being spun on both sides, there are degrees, though, aren't there? Because when you look at sort of the Remain side's main arguments, they are the economy will get worse. And, you know, you can quibble with some figures, but they have basically every economist in the world who can add up saying, yes, it's going to be bad. Whereas the Leave side's main arguments are about this figure of 350 million, which everyone repeats, which isn't true. This idea that we'll control immigration, where actually we might not. It's not quite sort of, you know, a plague on both your houses, is it?
No, I think that the stories on the Leave side, on the Brexit side, have been the biggest porkies. They've actually had clear inaccuracies and clear, you know, untruths that they've gone on repeating again and again and again in the Goebbels fashion of finally you'll believe it. The trouble is on the Remain side, they have had a certain number of spuriously accurate forecasts. You know, every household will be £4,300 worse off, which is just a bit silly. And I think it's the credibility on both sides that's been challenged. So the credibility on the one side of David Cameron, who is seen as, well, isn't he at heart really pretty anti-European? On the other side, the credibility of his biggest rival, Boris Johnson, who is actually half suspected of being a bit more pro-European than David Cameron. So I think people are quite justified in saying, well, what do we believe? Because and I don't think people have been really getting at the fundamental facts of this debate, which to my mind should be about the European Union as the greatest peace project of the second half of the 20th century, and now it's a peace project and a security project, not just a matter of economics.
Isabel, we'll come on to that issue about sort of is it a peace project and should that have been pushed a little bit more. But something Quentin just touched on there is that, you know, on both sides, everyone's been pretty absolute. It's, you know, they are fundamentally for Remain, they are fundamentally for Leave, when actually the truth about these politicians is that they often aren't. David Cameron has probably, if you look at all his speeches about Europe over the last year, probably the vast majority have been critical of Europe rather than in favour of. Do you think actually this campaign would have been a little more honest if politicians had been like, well, you know, look, I'm 60-40 this way?
Possibly. And I do think that there's a long-term problem that since Edward Heath, not a single British Prime Minister has made a positive case for Europe. And you know, we have this in common with quite a few other leaders that, you know, you're going to a European Council meeting, European summit, and you basically say you're going to, you know, go in and fight for our team, and you come back and say our team won and we bash the foreigner. Every single leader tends to do that because that's how you present your relationship with in a negotiation. But the cumulative effect of this and the tendency of, again, of national politicians to blame the EU for things that are probably their fault has just generated a kind of, you know, a vacuum of enthusiasm for all the remarkable things that the European Union is and has achieved.
On that point, Quentin, from Isabel, about people and politicians blaming Europe for things that are not Europe's fault. We've almost forgotten that in this country a year ago, we had a general election and we had a political party that stood on a very clear message that there would be cuts, severe cuts to public services. And so that would mean less money for schools, less money for hospitals, less money for public services across the board. And now people are turning around and saying, oh my God, I can't get my kid into school. Oh my God, I can't get a GP appointment. It must be the immigrants.
Yes, and this is the terrible thing about the debate. I think the poisonous side of it has been the anti-immigration line. And if at the end of the day it's immigration rather than anything else that decides it, it will be a very bad thing, I think, for the entire atmosphere in Great Britain. Because it has been used as the bashing immigration by the Brexit side as the key to really get their supporters motivated and to the polls. And clearly there is a lot of unhappiness at the extent of immigration. I think it's somewhat dishonest. It's all been turned on European Union migrants, but actually a lot of the irritation and frustration is with migrants from outside the European Union, over whom we do have control. I don't particularly want to see it tightened. Nobody has had a positive story to tell about immigration in this country. And it's one of the tragedies because it is fundamentally a very positive story for the economy, for filling our shortages of labour, for keeping our National Health Service going. That message simply hasn't got through.
And indeed for the future in an ageing society, you need fresh blood. You need inward migration. And as Quentin said, I mean, there is a slightly fact-free element to the migration discussion because it has been played on emotion and frankly racism, you know, that inward migrants contribute more than they take out. These figures are very, very clear. This is a benefit.
Overall, yes, absolutely. However, you know, some people will say, look, in certain parts of the country, that isn't the case because, yes, okay, GDP has grown, but actually, unless you send more money to those areas where there are now more migrants, there will be a strain on public services.
That's a policy choice. And in fact, the late and much lamented Joe Cox had a very good remedy for that, which was that you create a migration fund for exactly those areas where people are suffering from, you know, actually not simply from migration, but from the loss of the demand for their skills, from the deindustrialization, from all those things that we know have contributed to a working class which no longer works. But that's within the remit of the British government to remedy had they chosen to.
Part of the debate here, Quentin, is not just about Europe and not just about immigration, but it's about the fact that globalisation, while overall being seen as a good thing for a country as a whole and for the West as a whole, has meant lots of people have been left behind. Lots of jobs have gone, lots of industries have gone and haven't been replaced. And what we're seeing here is very similar in some ways to what we're seeing in the US with Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders.
the demographic that is actually voting for Brexit is a very similar demographic, I think, to the demographic that's voting for Donald Trump. And they are people who feel left behind. They are people who feel threatened. Their perception is they're threatened by immigrants who are prepared to work for less money, also by technology, which is taking away their jobs. And it's very clear, if you look at the pattern of potential voting in Britain, that it is the rather sad little seaside towns that have got left behind by history that are voting for Brexit. And London, full of immigrants and fundamentally very prosperous, is very clear London wants to remain in the European Union.
There have been essentially two different campaigns going on here, haven't there, Isabel? There's been the campaign over immigration, with the Leave side wanting to talk about that and the Remain side rather preferring not to engage with it. And then there's been the economic argument, which the Remain side have very much wanted to focus on, and the Leave campaign have refused to. So in a sense, it's come down to whether you can shout loudest about your own issue and get your issue to be number one.
And the problem with that is that the economic arguments tend to appear abstract and complicated and come from organisations with funny acronyms. And you know, whether you have too many migrants on your street is an emotional issue, and it's one of those dog whistle things. What was interesting, however, that in the big debate last night, when the Leave side were challenged on the control of migration, they were challenged to set a target, they were challenged to say how they would control migration, they didn't even promise to control migration. They couldn't answer it. So they whipped up this issue, they whipped up the emotions around it, and they don't have a strategy at all. You know, then they can't answer their own question.
Quentin, before we come on to looking at Europe itself and how it views here, paint us a picture, and you know, by all means, you know, make it a dark, horrible picture, if you think that's the one, of Britain in a year's time, if we vote to leave, and if that issue on immigration, as Isabel's just pointed out there, if actually immigration isn't, to use their words, under control, hasn't reduced, because there's no guarantee that it will. What does that do to people in this country if they've voted for this under the basis, under the idea that they're going to somehow essentially get rid of the foreigners and they're all still here?
Yeah, and I think the immediate thing that might well happen is that a lot of the European Union migrants who are here will actually rush to bring their families in, who they'd up to now left at home, because they won't be able to get in later. So actually, we may very well see an increase in European migration. Nothing will have taken away the pressures for to do more about the refugee disaster in the Middle East, coming from Syria and Iraq and so on. So all the pressures remain, and I think it'll be very difficult. The Brexit people, particularly the Conservatives among the Brexit people, are actually repeating the promise, which was always going to be impossible to fulfil, that we could get immigration down to tens of thousands. So you say, what would it be like here? I think we'd have a very vengeful electorate that said, hang on, you too promised us all these wonderful bonanza just by leaving Europe. What have you done? And I think what's the real worry is that on Friday morning, there will be, if there's a Brexit vote, on, and we'll get it in the early hours of the morning, on Friday morning, the financial markets will really turn on the pound, the London Stock Exchange, maybe with a knock-on effect on other European markets. There's real worries in the City of London that we're going to face a very stormy day, and even rumours that they might be preparing to close the London Stock Exchange if it's too rough.
Wow. OK, so a recession followed by a vengeful electorate. Looking forward to already.
It's going to be fun.
Isabel, let's look at the British Isles. You know, the United Kingdom is, of course, four nations: England, Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland. Then, of course, there's the relationship with the Republic of Ireland as well. England is more out than in, I think it's probably fair to say. Wales, a bit more on the fence. Northern Ireland and certainly Scotland, very much for Remain. What does this mean for the United Kingdom if actually the UK as a whole leaves, but large constituent parts of it would rather have remained?
It's really quite difficult to begin to describe the constitutional chaos that is going to ensue or is likely to ensue if there is a Leave vote. I mean, if you open that cupboard marked British Constitution, a whole bunch of things fall out, you know, kind of mixture of grandfather's axe, granny's knickers, some wedding presents, you know, the EU acquis communautaire, and the Scotland Act. Now, interestingly, the Scotland Act, for a start, you it's not clear what we would be leaving. We have this advisory referendum, which says, do you want to leave the EU or stay in the EU? So suppose the British people in their wisdom say we want to leave. What exactly are we leaving? Are we leaving the single market? Are we leaving the EU? These are pertinent questions in terms of unravelling the legislation. We have something like 12,000 regulations which are in British codes and in British practice, which are EU regulations. We have 40 years of EU law encoded in British law. Which of those are we keeping? Which of those are we not keeping? This is a task which will take years and has the potential for an argument in every one. Add to that the complication that the Scotland Act automatically incorporates EU law into Scottish law, and the Scotland Act also says that law which is not compatible with EU law cannot be encoded in Scottish law. So do we have to reopen the whole question of the Scotland Act? And the Scotland Act, of course, would be defended by a country that didn't want to leave anyway. So you have, you know, a massive potential for a constitutional crisis just in the working out of the rules.
Does this, Quentin, lead inevitably to the breakup of the United Kingdom, to, in a sense, actually English independence?
Well, I think that there is a likelihood that we'll have another Scottish referendum in the foreseeable future, maybe not in a matter of months, because it would suddenly, of course, be a much more difficult decision if one country is likely to end up inside the EU and the other country is likely to end up outside the EU. And we may look at that in a second in the question of Ireland. But I think that there is a much increased possibility of a breakup of the United Kingdom if we have a Brexit vote. I think that's very real.
And this will be preceded by a series of rows between Edinburgh, between the Holyrood Parliament and Westminster, over, for instance, the devolution back to the United Kingdom of powers that had been vested in the EU, like agricultural policy. You know, Scotland would want that. You know, it wouldn't want it to see it. It's not in the Scotland Act because it was in Brussels. But if that all unravels, then Scotland is going to stake a claim to large parts of that agenda that it would like to see in, under the Scottish Parliament.
The other constitutional nightmare is that a referendum will have taken a decision, leave the EU, for which there is no majority in the Westminster Parliament.
Absolutely.
So you actually have, it's as if you had created a third chamber of Parliament, in which is called a referendum, which is in conflict with the other two chambers of Parliament. That's not
but which is not sovereign. But what is sovereign is the Parliament, is the Westminster Parliament.
I'm sure it's sovereign, but I cannot see a single MP standing up and saying, I'm going to ignore the express wishes of the British people.
But that's not the point.
And go against it.
It's not about the express wishes of the British people. It's about, you know, the referendum is you know, says leave the European Union. It doesn't deal with the aftermath. The aftermath is enormous and will take years.
No,
and
I completely accept that. I think my point is
this is going to be a fight.
I think my point is there is that yes, there may well be a vast majority of MPs that would rather Britain remained in the European Union, but if actually the country votes to leave.
Yeah.
But
we
when
leave.
They get to the detail...
Yeah, it's the detail that matters. So because there's no clarity about how we leave. So if that majority says, but we want to remain in the single market, which means maintaining free movement of people, that's not spelt out in this referendum decision. It just says, do you want to remain or leave? Mm. So we've got this incredibly complicated period, 2 years to negotiate our exit, and then maybe 8-10 years to negotiate a new trading relationship. It's a complete nightmare, and we don't have the negotiation. I'm told we have 35 trade negotiators in London at the moment, and we're going to need more than 700.
Yeah, well, we haven't had trade negotiators since 1973, because, again, that went to Europe. So we don't know how to negotiate trade deals anymore.
Okay, if you speak more than one language and you know how to negotiate a trade deal, call
Could you turn up
whoever's living at number 10 Downing Street on Friday, rock up. they'll be very happy to see you. Let's broaden this out and look at Europe, Quentin. So let's say we have Brexit. Do we then have Frexit, Nexit, Denexit, Finexit? Better acronyms? Portmanteau, rather?
There's a real worry about a sort knock-on effect to several countries. Let's look at those who are most worried, actually, about what the consequences are. Ireland is top. Mm. Sweden, interestingly enough, seems to be the next.
Ireland is worried, but not in a sort of, therefore, we'll leave. Ireland is just like, you're our major trading partner. We'd far prefer if you stayed.
The interest, Ireland is not even contemplating leaving itself, but the consequences of Britain leaving and Ireland not leaving are dramatic. You'd have a border across the country. I have no doubt at all they'd have to create a new border. The Irish Taoiseach had an article just published yesterday saying this could destabilise not just the entire economy of South and Northern Ireland, but also the politics. We could see an unravelling of the peace process. So
But Quentin, he's a foreigner. No one wants to listen to him.
I've heard a lot say they're very worried. The contribution, the fact of the European Union being like an umbrella over the peace process, was hugely important in its success. The Republicans laid down their weapons because they were persuaded that they were all essentially in the same union. Now, if we had a Brexit, the most extreme Republicans are going to say, hang on, you've now taken away some fundamental reasons for the reasons we put away our weapons. Maybe we need to go back to war. So I think it's a real worry. But that's very specific to Ireland. If you look at the rest of the European Union, they are worried. I don't think they're worried that other countries are going to literally put their hands up and say, we want to leave as well. But you may get people demanding referendums in Denmark, Sweden, the Netherlands and Italy.
And France,
perhaps. Indeed. In fact, on that point as well. So, we've heard today people within the Five Star Movement in Italy saying perhaps we should have a referendum. In France, obviously, Marine Le Pen, one of the only politicians in Europe who will be cheering on a British exit. She is going to be campaigning on France exiting the European Union, despite all the benefits that many of her voters will get. But let's not get into that that right now. What do you think happens next in Europe?
That is a large and, again, rather layered question, because it does, it will vary from country to country. But Marine Le Pen is a worry. Marine Le Pen did pretty well in the first round of the last election. Mm. So she is a force to be reckoned with. There are, I suppose, two options. One is that the shock of the British exit galvanises Europe to undergo its own reform process, because I think that one positive result of this otherwise what I consider a fiasco, is that it has brought out of the woodwork quite a lot of pro-reform sentiments within Europe. It's not just Britain that wants reform. And so I think that those that remain, I think rather than precipitate a rush to the door, I think that it might precipitate a kind of, okay, so how do we make sure this doesn't happen again? What's the agenda for reform? What are the complaints? And that does including for Germany, the devolution of certain powers back to national parliaments, these are perennial questions in Europe, and they do get adjusted and modulated. And I think that on a positive side, it might do that. On the negative side, we might see, another country with a strident demand for a referendum that can't be denied.
Quentin, how much mood is there for reform within the European Union, within sort of the leadership of sort of the key countries? Because, of course, they are slightly bound by the fact that no one wants to change a treaty, because treaty change means in certain countries referendums, or at least sort of votes in parliament. So within those confines, is there space and is there appetite for reform?
I think that the direction of reform would be in the direction Isabel's talking about. That's to say, how can we actually bring back a bit more authority to national parliaments? I think the fundamental thing is, how do we make the whole European Union system more responsive in a democratic way? Now, it's much more responsive than a lot of people maintain. There is genuinely democratic control, but it's not national democratic control. It's this multinational, a European Parliament and a Council of Ministers, which have both got 28 member states involved. So it's not familiar to a lot of people. I think that there would be a real attempt to, if you like, give a bit new momentum to the whole European idea. But all I'm hearing at the moment is more foreign and security policy, and let's desperately try and find a deal on refugees and the whole migration situation, which is the really most explosive issue.
There is another factor that we should perhaps look at, that if the aftermath of a Brexit vote is as bad for Britain as I suspect we think it's going to be, we could simply be the big negative example, and it might indeed temper the demand for referenda in other countries. You know, if the British economy tanks, if, you know, politics are paralysed, if things really go badly, we would be a great argument for Europe.
Let's bring it back at the end now to Britain, and let's assume that there is a Leave vote, and following on from that, let's assume, as many political analysts are saying, indeed many of David Cameron's own MPs are saying, that the Prime Minister has to step down. We're then in this strange situation, aren't we, Quentin, where the Conservative Party has to choose a new leader, and that new leader will automatically become Prime Minister, despite the fact that it'll probably be one of the Leavers, and despite the fact they just had a big campaign about how undemocratic the EU is. They'll become Prime Minister without a vote. Are we then going to have a new general election?
I think we may very well have to, actually. I think I agree that David Cameron, I don't think, can survive. Really matter, it'll be a matter of weeks, I think, before he goes, if there's a Brexit vote. His position will have been dramatically weakened. The Conservative Party itself has been actually engaged in the most poisonous and bloody civil war. The party's got to heal its wounds. I wouldn't be surprised if they desperately look for somebody who will be more in the middle to try and bring them together. But then you get this problem of going to the House of Commons and saying, right, we want out of the single market, we want out of everything. There might be no majority for a proposal like that within the House of Commons, and then they have to go for an election because this new Prime Minister needs a new mandate. I think there would be a lot of pressure for that. Meanwhile, over on the continent, we have 27 partners in the European Union who are saying, hang on, we can't sit around forever in total uncertainty, destabilising the markets. We don't know where we're going. Get your act together, because we need to know.
Also on that point, sorry, just to, as a little tangent, they can't kick us out. It's Britain itself that has to sort of sign a piece of paper saying we're leaving, isn't it?
It is at one level, but I think if that process were postponed indefinitely, there would be pressure building up to somehow suspend membership. I mean, if Britain...
We just wouldn't get the invites to the meetings.
Well, no, it's more than that. If we start to slam the controls on free movement, or if we announce that we're not going to respect any further decisions of the European Court of Justice, we will then be actually calling our whole membership into question without Article 50 to do it formally.
And Isabel, just finally back to sort of the British political situation. Let's say there's a new Prime Minister. Let's say there's a vote. We've there a general election. We're then in this weird mix where you have this, as Quentin says, this sort of poisonous atmosphere inside the Conservative Party. You've already got a very split Labour Party led by a leader that hasn't sort of set the country alight. Plus then obviously a very popular leader of the Scottish Nationalists up in Scotland. We're heading for another little mess, aren't we?
It's a complete mess. You've also got a rather popular leader of the Scottish Conservatives. She may not do very well electorally in Scotland, but she'd certainly be a breath of fresh air in Westminster. Perhaps that's an interim solution.
Although, sorry, just to, I know you were trying to finish on a light note there. Quentin, let's bring us back and make to the darkness.
More disaster.
No, well, we haven't mentioned Nigel Farage and UKIP. And he is going to, okay, they only have one MP, but that's because of the vagaries of our electoral system. It doesn't take much for them to suddenly go from 1 to 150.
Yeah, first-past-the-post system has always screwed them up till now. But actually, yes, I think they would come through very clearly as the third power in the land, and they might hold any future government to ransom, so you've got to do a deal with us.
Well, there we are. That's... the end of Midori House. Not the end of civilization. Don't worry, not the end of civilization. My thanks to Quentin Peel and to Isabel Hilton. Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Guy Lutz and Marie Justy. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Do tune in all day tomorrow. Globalist Briefing, Midori and The Daily will be bringing you reaction and analysis. And of course, later on tonight, you've got the Monocle Daily 2200 hours. Do stay tuned for that. My name is Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.